The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo, Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works, Chapter 11, The Master of the Work, page 243. The Master of the Work. The master and mover of our works is the One, the Universal and Supreme, the Eternal and Infinite. He is the transcendent unknown or unknowable absolute, the unexpressed and unmanifested ineffable above us. But he is also the self of all beings, the master of all worlds, transcending all worlds, the light and the guide, the all-beautiful and all-blissful, the beloved and the lover. He is the cosmic spirit and all creating energy around us. He is the immanent within us. All that he is, and he is the more than all that is, and we ourselves, though we know it not, are being of his being, force of his force, conscious with a consciousness derived from his. Even our mortal existence is made out of his substance. And there is an immortal within us that is a spark of the light and bliss that are forever. No matter whether by knowledge, works, love, or any other means, to become aware of this truth of our being, to realize it, to make it effective here or elsewhere, is the object of all yoga. But the passage is long, and the labor arduous before we can look on him with eyes that see true, and still longer and more arduous must be our endeavor if we would rebuild ourselves in his true image. The master of the work does not reveal himself at once to the seeker. Always, it is his power that acts behind the veil, but it is manifest only when we renounce the egoism of the worker. And its direct movement increases in proportion as that renunciation becomes more and more complete. Only when our surrender to his divine Shakti is absolute, shall we have the right to live in his absolute presence. And only then can we see our work throw itself naturally, completely, and simply into the mold of the divine will. There must, therefore, be stages and gradations in our approach to this perfection, as there are in the progress towards all other perfection on any plane of nature. The vision of the full glory may come to us before, suddenly or slowly, once or often, but until the foundation is complete, it is a summary and concentrated, not a durable and all-enveloping experience, not a lasting presence. The amplitudes, the infinite contents of the divine revelation come afterwards and unroll gradually their power and their significance. Or even, the steady vision can be there on the summits of our nature. But the perfect response of the lower members comes only by degrees. In all yoga, the first requisites are faith and patience. The ardors of the heart and the violences of the eager will that seek to take the kingdom of heaven by storm can have miserable reactions if they disdain to support their vehemence on these humbler and quieter auxiliaries. And in the long and difficult integral yoga, there must be an integral faith and an unshakable patience. It is difficult to acquire or to practice this faith and steadfastness on the rough and narrow path of yoga because of the impatience of both heart and mind and the eager but soon faltering will of our rajasic nature. The vital nature of man hungers always for the fruit of its labor. And if the fruit appears to be denied or long delayed, he loses faith in the ideal and in the guidance. For his mind judges always by the appearance of things, since that is the first ingrained habit of the intellectual reason in which he so inordinately trusts. Nothing is easier for us than to accuse God in our hearts that we suffer long, or stumble in the darkness, or to abjure the ideal that we have set before us. For we say, I have trusted to the highest, and I am betrayed into suffering and sin and error. Or else, I have staked my whole life on an idea which the stern facts of experience contradict and discourage. It would have been better to be as other men are, who accept their limitations and walk on the firm ground of normal experience. In such moments, and they are sometimes frequent and long, all the higher experience is forgotten, and the heart concentrates itself in its own bitterness. It is in these dark passages that it is possible to fall for good, or to turn back from the divine labor. If one has walked long and steadily in the path, the faith of the heart will remain under the fiercest adverse pressure. Even if it is concealed or apparently overborne, it will take the first opportunity to re-emerge. For something higher than either heart or intellect upholds it in spite of the worst stumblings and through the most prolonged failure. But even to the experienced sadhaka, such falterings or overcloudings bring a retardation of his progress, and they are exceedingly dangerous to the novice. It is therefore necessary, from the beginning, to understand and accept the arduous difficulty of the path, and to feel the need of a faith, which to the intellect may seem blind, but yet is wiser than our reasoning intelligence. For this faith is a support from above. It is the brilliant shadow thrown by a secret light that exceeds the intellect and its data. It is the heart of a hidden knowledge that is not at the mercy of immediate appearances. Our faith, persevering, will be justified in its works and will be lifted and transfigured at last into the self-revelation of a divine knowledge. Always we must adhere to the injunction of the Gita. Yoga must be continually applied with the heart free from despondent sinking. Always we must repeat to the doubting intellect the promise of the Master. I will surely deliver thee from all sin and evil. Do not grieve. At the end, the flickerings of faith will cease, for we shall see his face and feel always the divine presence. The master of our works respects our nature even when he is transforming it. He works always through the nature and not by any arbitrary caprice. This imperfect nature of ours contains the materials of our perfection, but inchoate, distorted, misplaced, thrown together in disorder or a poor imperfect order. All this material has to be patiently perfected, purified, reorganized, new molded, and transformed, not hacked and hewn and slain or mutilated, not obliterated by simple coercion and denial. This world, and we who live in it, are his creation and manifestation, and he deals with it and us in a way our narrow and ignorant mind cannot understand unless it falls silent and opens to a divine knowledge. In our errors is the substance of a truth which labors to reveal its meaning to our groping intelligence. The human intellect cuts out the error and the truth with it and replaces it by another half-truth, half-error. But the divine wisdom suffers our mistakes to continue until we are able to arrive at the truth hidden and protected under every false cover. Our sins are the misdirected steps of a seeking power that aims not at sin, but at perfection, at something that we might call a divine virtue. Often, they are the veils of a quality that has to be transformed and delivered out of this ugly disguise. Otherwise, in the perfect providence of things, they would not have been suffered to exist or to continue. The master of our works is neither a blunderer, nor an indifferent witness, nor a dallier with the luxury of unneeded evils. He is wiser than our reason and wiser than our virtue. Our nature is not only mistaken in will and ignorant in knowledge, but weak in power. But the divine force is there and will lead us if we trust in it. And it will use our deficiencies and our powers for the divine purpose. If we fail in our immediate aim, it is because he has intended the failure. Often our failure or ill result is the right road to a truer issue than an immediate and complete success would have put in our reach. If we suffer, it is because something in us has to be prepared for a rarer possibility of delight. If we stumble, it is to learn in the end the secret of a more perfect walking. Let us not be in too furious a haste to acquire even peace, purity, and perfection. Peace must be ours, but not the peace of an empty or devastated nature, or of slain or mutilated capacities incapable of unrest because we have made them incapable of intensity and fire and force. Purity must be our aim, but not the purity of a void or of a bleak and rigid coldness. Perfection is demanded of us, but not the perfection that can exist only by confining its scope within narrow limits or putting an arbitrary full stop to the ever self-extending scroll of the infinite. Our object is to change into the divine nature. But the divine nature is not a mental or moral, but a spiritual condition, difficult to achieve, difficult even to conceive by our intelligence. The master of our work and our yoga knows the thing to be done, and we must allow him to do it in us by his own means and in his own manner. The movement of the ignorance is egoistic at its core, and nothing is more difficult for us than to get rid of egoism while yet we admit personality and adhere to action in the half-light and half-force of our unfinished nature. It is easier to starve the ego by renouncing the impulse to act, or to kill it by cutting away from us all movement of personality. It is easier to exalt it into self-forgetfulness immersed in a trance of peace or an ecstasy of divine love. But our more difficult problem is to liberate the true person and attain to a divine manhood which shall be the pure vessel of a divine force and the perfect instrument of a divine action. Step after step has to be firmly taken. Difficulty after difficulty has to be entirely experienced and entirely mastered. Only the divine wisdom and power can do this for us, and it will do all if we yield to it in an entire faith and follow and assent to its workings with a constant courage and patience. The first step on this long path is to consecrate all our works as a sacrifice to the divine in us and in the world. This is an attitude of the mind and heart, not too difficult to initiate, but very difficult to make absolutely sincere and all-pervasive. The second step is to renounce attachment to the fruit of our works. For the only true, inevitable, and utterly desirable fruit of sacrifice, the one thing needful, is the divine presence and the divine consciousness and power in us. And if that is gained, all else will be added. This is a transformation of the egoistic will in our vital being, our desire soul and desire nature, and it is far more difficult than the other. The third step is to get rid of the central egoism and even the ego sense of the worker. That is the most difficult transformation of all, and it cannot be perfectly done if the first two steps have not been taken. But these first steps, too, cannot be completed unless the third comes in to crown the movement and, by the extinction of egoism, eradicates the very origin of desire. Only when the small ego sense is rooted out from the nature can the seeker know his true person that stands above as a portion and power of the divine and renounce all motive force other than the will of the divine Shakti.